when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Today, we discuss the latest news from the front lines as Russian forces advance on Chasiv Yar. We take the political temperature in Germany, and Francis Sternley interviews Ukraine's interim ambassador to the UK, Eduard Fesco.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
If we give President Zelensky the tools, the Ukrainians will finish the job. Slava Ukraini!
Nobody's gonna break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Friday, the 3rd of May, 2 years and 70 days since the full-scale invasion began. And today I'm joined by our associate editor Dominic Nichols, assistant comment editor Francis Sternley, and Berlin correspondent James Rothwell. I started by asking Dom for the latest news from Ukraine.
Well, hi David, hi everybody. So there's an attack underway now in Kharkiv. It started an hour ago. A powerful explosion was heard in central Kharkiv. This is coming from the Kyiv Independent Reporter, who's there on the ground. Governor Oleh Sinobinov said a Russian attack against the city and the surrounding district was underway. He said there had been strikes in residential areas of the Kolodnoryski district. Several buildings were destroyed and people are trapped under the rubble, Mayor Ihor Terekhov says. He also said a tram with passengers was hit. It's thought that this is largely glide bombs that are hitting Kharkiv now. One death reported so far, but that's ongoing as we speak. We'll keep an eye on breaking news for that over the next hour. Separately, Russia has claimed victory in a village of Badichi in the Donetsk region in the east of the country after bitter fighting there. So that is about 5 km northwest of Avdiivka, about the same distance southeast of Ocheretine. That village is at the top of this salient bulge that Russia's been able to force over that what's now thought to have been a botched relief in place by the Ukrainian forces, as in a force coming in to take over the positions that were currently held. In that mix-up, it's always quite tricky about who's in control of what, who's in command of the ground, etc., etc. They seem to have got that wrong, and it allowed a bit of a push through last week by Russia. So in that bulge, the village they're saying, Badichi, that they've taken yesterday, that's on the southern flank, if you like, of that salient. Now, a senior Ukrainian military official speaking yesterday said the situation on the front line in the east is worsening, but local defenders are so far holding firm against this concerted push by Russia's bigger and better equipped forces. And Nazar Volyshin, who's a spokesperson for Ukrainian Strategic Command in the east of the country, says Russia has amassed troops in the Donetsk region in an effort to try to punch through the Ukrainian defensive line. Speaking on national television, he said the enemy is trying to seize the strategic initiative and breach our defence. The enemy is actively attacking along the entire front line and in several directions. They have achieved certain tactical advances. The situation is changing dynamically. And now, yesterday, Russia targeted a total of 8 Ukrainian oblasts, ranging from Chernihiv in the north down to Kherson in the south and everywhere east of that line. Civilians, including children, have been killed and others injured. Sumy Oblast experienced over 200 explosions and glide bombs hit civilian infrastructure and private houses in the Kharkiv region yesterday, as it is doing now. Children and adults injured there in Kharkiv. That was yesterday. But there have been deaths, or at least one death reported so far today in Kharkiv. Now, there's a big interview in The Economist, which is online now. The paper comes out today. It's trailed online. I think there's a bigger interview in the paper itself with the Ukrainian Military Intelligence Agency's deputy head, a chap we've met before, Major General Vadim Skibitsky. General Skibitsky says things are as difficult as they have ever been since the early days of the full-scale invasion. He says the Russian order has gone out to, in his words, take something in time for Victory Day in Moscow on May the 9th, next Thursday, or failing that before Putin's visit to Beijing a week later. General Skibitsky says our problem is very simple. We have no weapons. They always knew April and May would be a difficult time for us. He said the immediate concern is the town of Chasiv Yar could hold the keys to onward Russian advance to the last large cities in the Donetsk region. General Skibitsky said the Russian army is not the hubristic organization it was in 2022 and is now operating as a single body with a clear plan and under a single command. He said Russia has 514,000 troops committed to the Ukrainian war now, and said Moscow is gearing up for an assault around Kharkiv and Sumy regions at the end of May or beginning of June. Now, he noted Russia's northern grouping, based across the border from Kharkiv, so inside Russia, is currently 35,000 strong, but is set to expand to between 50 and 70,000 troops. He says Russia is generating a division of reserves, up to 20,000, something like that, in central Russia, which they can add to the main effort. He says this is not enough for an operation to take a major city such as Kharkiv, which is a judgment shared by Western military officials, but it could be enough for a smaller task or to try and take a chunk of territory. He said a quick operation to come in and out, perhaps, but an operation to take Kharkiv or even Sumy city is of a different order. He spoke to a number of other themes, including Russia's disinformation campaign and the work to isolate Ukraine internationally. And he said that Ukraine's bravery and sacrifice have given Europe a multi-year head start on Russia, removing the immediate threat from Russia's once feared airborne forces and Marine Corps for at least a decade. But he said the question is whether Europe will repay the favour by keeping Ukraine in the game. We will keep fighting, he said. We have no choice. We want to live. But the outcome of the war isn't just down to us. So keep an eye out for the full interview in the Economist later today. Next one, Finland's new armed forces chief said Russia was unlikely to test NATO's mutual defence clause, Article 5, by attacking a NATO member state in the coming years, but may well continue what he said were hybrid attacks such as jamming, we've seen that this week, over emanating out of Kaliningrad, and election interference. So speaking to Reuters, General Hanna Jaakkola said, of course, testing the Article 5 is always possible, but if we take correct action and maintain unity, I consider an attack unlikely. The point for the Russians is that they wish to cause as much division in Europe as possible, kind of what General Skibitsky was saying, so that our unity and cohesion is a bit weaker. Okay, one more for me. Today's British Defence Intelligence update, I thought was quite interesting. It says, over the course of this week, the Ukrainian attack on the Russian airfield of Kushchevskaya, that's in the Russian oblast east of the Sea of Azov, British Defence MOD saying those attacks have likely contributed to approximately 40 aircraft of different types being moved from there and dispersed to other airfields further from the front line. They say the impact of this is unlikely to be immediately obvious or dramatic. However, Ukraine has already demonstrated the ability to strike much further into Russia than these dispersal locations. Forcing such measures means that length of sorties, as in the time the aircraft can stay in the air, will have to increase to maintain the same permanency over the battle space. It's got further to go, can have less time actually in the battle space. This will in turn require more fuel, increasing cost, while also placing more strain on the air crews. I mean, that is the effect of these long-range strikes. You have to disperse your force, and then it puts more pressure on the system. And I'll take a little pause there, David.
Well, thank you so much, Dom. Francis, can you talk us through the political and diplomatic updates?
Well, thanks, David. In yet more evidence this morning that Western nations are incrementally loosening the handcuffs on Ukraine in terms of weapons and, crucially, use of weapons, the British Foreign Secretary Lord Cameron has said today, after visiting Kyiv and meeting with President Zelensky, that Ukraine is permitted to use British weapons to strike inside of Russia. To quote him, Ukraine has that right. Just as Russia is striking inside Ukraine, you can quite understand why Ukraine feels the need to make sure it's defending itself. Now, Lord Cameron's visit follows the British government's announcement that it will commit at least £3 billion a year in military support to Ukraine, with the latest donation including precision-guided bombs, air defence missiles and equipment for 100 mobile air defence teams to enable Kyiv to shoot down drones and missiles across the country. "We've just really emptied all we can in terms of giving equipment," Cameron told Reuters, meaning, I think, that Britain is not holding anything in reserve, rather than saying that this will be it and there's nothing more to come in the future. He also confirmed a £36 million package of support, including £20 million in new emergency funding with regard to infrastructure. Now, it would be remiss not to mention the Kremlin's reaction to this, which is telling. It's accused Lord Cameron of making dangerous remarks that imperil European security. At least they didn't threaten to use nukes this time. Now, Cameron also met Dmytro Kuleba, Ukraine's foreign minister, who this week also gave another very interesting interview to Foreign Affairs, following the one from Savitsky that Dom was just talking about. Now, again, as with that important one-on-one with President Macron in The Economist that I summarised yesterday, I can't do justice to its entirety here, but I can only summarise some of the key points. When asked what impact the passage of the US aid package had on morale in the government, he says, and I quote, "Well, it was definitely a boost for morale among Ukrainian soldiers and also among the people of Ukraine. If the package that was announced immediately after adoption of the law had contained a battery of patriots, this boost would have been even stronger because Ukrainians suffer the most from Russian missile attacks. Russian ballistic missiles are the real scourge of this war. They've been mainly used recently to destroy our energy system. I will dare to say that if another country suffered this scale of energy destruction, it would look much, much worse than Ukraine. We hold on because we've learned a lot. We are resilient. We know what the stakes are. But just to give an understanding to your viewers, half our energy system is damaged and we still have to run the country, run the war effort and rally the world's support." "Does the aid package change your military strategy?" he was asked next. His response: "There is a time gap between the announcement of the package and the moment when a Ukrainian artilleryman has more shells to fire back at the invaders. And that moment has not come yet, because everything that was announced, we are grateful and we appreciate it, is still on its way. And therefore, in this time gap, bad things may happen, such as the advance of Russian forces on the ground. The artillery ratio on the ground is incomprehensible. Basically, Ukrainian soldiers are starving because of the lack of artillery ammunition. And in the end, they get bombed and their position gets destroyed. So what really matters in terms of the war is not only the quantity and the quality of what is being provided, but also the timeline. And unfortunately, I have to admit that Ukraine's allies are behind schedule despite their efforts. Some of them are making a great effort. But when I look at what Russia achieved in restoring the production of its defenders' industrial base and what the entire West has achieved so far, we have to face the truth and recognise Russia is more effective in its war effort. And this raised a more fundamental question to the West. If it cannot be efficient enough in this particular war effort, then how efficient can it be if other wars and crises of the same scale break out?" Now, just as an aside here, this is completely consistent with what Podolyak, one of Zelensky's closest advisors, and Danilov, then head of the war cabinet, told me on the record for the podcast when I was in Kyiv. So I recommend listeners to listen to those interviews when they were saying this, what, back in early February. Now, Kuleba also stresses the importance of needing radio jamming because, he says, modern warfare is largely a war of drones and software, and therefore you need an abundance of electronic warfare to combat these modern state-of-the-art weapons. Another interesting insight later: "I have to admit that between late April and autumn, Europe was energising the United States. Probably for the first time since World War II, Europe took the lead whilst the US was deliberating. Europe realised it faced the reality of the war in Europe on its own and had to act. they adopted a decision on opening EU accession talks to Ukraine. They introduced the EU-Ukraine Facility, which is a multi-year macro-financial programme of assistance. Individual countries announced an unprecedented package of military assistance. In the volume of assistance provided to Ukraine, many countries have reached unimaginable levels compared to the immediate aftermath of the invasion in 2022. And just finally from this interview, he offers some interesting reflections on those countries that have been more favourable to Russia. Quote, China can do more to convince Russia to change its behaviour. This is why we invited China to take part in the Peace Formula Summit. Some countries believe that Russia shouldn't be pushed too far away in order to avoid a situation where Russia completely falls into the hands of China. And that imposes constraints on decisions taken with regard to supporting Ukraine. But the truth is that Russia is already in the hands of China, and there is nothing that can be bringing them back into a different reality. So this is just the wrong way of looking at the new balance that has been created. What I learned about the global south in the last 2 years is that it doesn't exist, that we have to treat every country separately. There is a huge difference between China and India, or between South Africa and Brazil. The mistake that we've made with regards to them was not made in 2022. It was in the late 1990s when we started paying attention to developing relations with these countries, while Russia inherited a lot from the Soviet Union. I have to admit, they are better positioned there. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't keep trying. Now, I know I've quoted quite a lot there, David, but it's a fascinating interview, which I'm sure listeners will agree much to ponder based on those remarks. And just very, very briefly, two other quick stories. The first showing just how difficult countries are finding it to maintain and manage Ukrainian refugees. Ireland is considering making further cuts to support and benefits for Ukrainian refugees as it struggles to house rising numbers of migrants arriving in the country more broadly from Europe. Indeed, some of those migrants, of course, being encouraged by Russia, which is an issue we've talked about in the past. Last year, Ireland already slashed its allowance for newly arrived Ukrainian refugees, saying it was at the limit of the support that it could offer. It cut payments for newly arrived Ukrainians in state accommodation to £33.19 a week from £188.19. We are looking into the Ukrainian refugee situation across Europe as we speak and hope to do a future episode on it. And finally, David, some international reaction to the events in Georgia this week, with US, EU and UN officials denouncing those efforts to pass that controversial foreign aid bill amid the ongoing protests. Quote, we are deeply concerned about this legislation, what it could do in terms of stifling dissent and free speech, US National Security Spokesman John Kirby, who of course Dom interviewed when we were in the US, said during a press briefing. This was echoed by the Director General of the European Commission's Enlargement Directorate, who said there are concerning developments in terms of legislation. The law as it stands is unacceptable and will create serious obstacles for the EU accession path. We must expect now this row to rumble on and escalate, I think, as we approach May 17th, when the third and final reading of the bill is scheduled. Quite an extraordinary event going on there in Georgia at the moment.
Well, thank you very much, Dom and Francis. James, can I come to you? There's a couple of stories I think we should talk about. We mentioned this in one of our updates earlier this week, but could you take us to Murnau and this arrest of a Russian man over the fatal stabbing of two Ukrainian soldiers? As I said, we've talked about it, but I think it'd be very good to hear your thoughts and just your sense of how this played out in the media in Germany. What was the reaction?
Thanks, David. Yes, rather grim story that came out of Murnau down in Bavaria. Bavaria, of course, the scene of another incident a few weeks ago where some German-Russian citizens were arrested on suspicion of plotting a bomb attack on US military sites. And so Bavaria seems to be cropping up an awful lot at the moment in the context of Russians causing trouble. This story, as listeners will remember, involves a Russian man being arrested on charges of murdering two wounded Ukrainian soldiers who had been on medical leave in Murnau. One of them very young, 23 years old, the other older soldier, 36. They'd been getting unspecified medical rehabilitation treatments when their Russian attacker ran up to them and stabbed them both in the neck area. One died at the scene, the other soldier sadly died in hospital. And the Russian suspect is in custody. Rather sordid case. The German police followed a blood trail from the scene of the attack, a shopping centre, all the way to this Russian attacker's apartment door, where they found more blood on his keyhole. And according to German media reports, he was very, very drunk when he was arrested. He confessed to the two killings immediately. And he also claimed that he'd recently had an argument with these two soldiers, suggesting that that may have been the motive for the attack. Very, very murky story, this. It is possible that this was an argument between a Russian and a Ukrainian that got out of hand. Possible, but I think not really that much. I mean, you know, we're talking about a knife attack, which involves some premeditation, perhaps. And of course, the fact that he is a Russian citizen, you know, is a very relevant detail to this as well. Like I said, the circumstantial reporting in the German press has led people to speculate that this was a lone attacker rather than something which may have had the involvement of the Russian security services. We don't know what exactly these two wounded Ukrainian soldiers had been doing, which caused them to be wounded. We're not quite sure what their sort of role in the Ukrainian military was. But what is clear is that it's really shocked, I think, quite a large Ukrainian community down in Murnau. There's lots of folks coming out to offer floral tributes, the blue and yellow flag. There was a big sign at the scene of the attack which said that the Ukrainian community of Murnau is in a profound state of grief over what had happened. And Germany has been thanked by the Ukrainian foreign ministry for arresting the suspect as soon as possible. He'll be charged, put on trial, and perhaps some more details of this very nasty case will come out at that point. But at the moment, yes, it's unfortunately just another case of tensions over the war, and perhaps, who knows, maybe something a bit more organised than that spilling over into a European country.
Well, thank you very much, James, for talking us through that. And as you said, we'll keep our eyes on this case, horrible as it is, very important. Can you take us back to Berlin? There's a really interesting piece you've written for The Telegraph about basically how the German army is thinking quite practically about what may happen if there was escalation, if it did have to house other Western troops. Talk to us about what the German army is thinking.
Yes, that's right. So the German army is working on what's called a civil defence document, which is trying to envisage all kinds of scenarios. It can range from things like natural disasters all the way up to armed conflict. And one of the most interesting details in this planning document, which is more or less top secret, but there are a few bits and pieces of information floating around about it, is the provision of food and fuel in a hypothetical scenario where thousands of US troops and their tanks use Germany to transit to the Eastern Front, presumably to fight a war with Russia. And I think what's quite interesting about this story is that it is just the latest example of how the German state is having to think about war planning in a way that it probably hasn't, certainly not since the Cold War, and perhaps even not since the beginning of the Second World War. We're talking about large-scale logistical organization plans dealing with, as I said, large numbers of US soldiers being hosted on their territory. This, as listeners will know, is all part of the Zeitenwende, the turning of the times, the Olaf Scholz pledge to make Germany a Kriegstuchtig or war-ready nation. And it does suggest that sincere efforts are underway in Germany to try and lay the groundwork for this. The specific tool that they're using, actually, which is quite interesting, is what they call maximum civilian provision. So this is a situation where the US, let's say, is at war with Russia. That means that Germany, as part of NATO, probably is at war with Russia too. That means that German military logistical capabilities are tied up. And it means that as part of this contingency planning document, the Germans are looking at how civilians might be able to support troops transiting through Germany. So one option they've looked at is civilian catering companies to host huge numbers of American soldiers. They've also talked about civilian petrol stations being commandeered by American troops who need to get fuel. And it might feel like a somewhat far-fetched scenario sitting here talking about it now, but I think what's key about this is it does reflect some big picture thinking on the part of Germany about a potential war with Russia. Of course, they're spending about 100 billion euros, they say, on defence at the moment. We'll just have to see how far some of that travels in terms of potentially getting ready to host lots of US soldiers. But the direction of travel does seem to be, as Boris Pistorius, the German defence minister, has said, preparations potentially for war with Russia within the next 5 years.
And James, finally, whenever we do get a correspondent on covering a particular country, it's always good to just to take the temperature of the country, really. When you look at the German media, talk to German friends, when you're going around Berlin, what's your sense of how Germans see the war in Ukraine? How has that changed since we last spoke in the last few months? Is it still at the top of the media? Are people still talking about it or not? What would you say to that?
it's not really at the top of the media agenda in Germany at the moment, I'd say. It was, of course, for many years, but then the Hamas massacre and the Gaza war has really knocked it to some extent out of the public discussion. Germany has become extremely polarised on the issue of Israel-Palestine in a way that it just wasn't on the war in Ukraine. Generally, yes, of course, there have been arguments in Germany between the so-called communist sympathising dwellers of East Germany and the supposedly more liberal left-leaning Westerners of Germany. There was a bit of that going on, but it is not like the situation over Israel-Palestine, where you've got this very, very, very rigid young-old divide on that specific issue, and pro-Palestinian protests and very, very heated political discussions about Israel-Palestine and anti-Semitism are a much bigger part of the news over here at the moment, and a much bigger part of the sort of atmosphere. You talk about what young-ish German people talk about at the pubs when I speak to them. It's Israel-Palestine, which is coming up much more often than Ukraine. Now, that might change soon. German elections are probably coming up next autumn, and the European elections, of course, are coming this June as well. And I think all the parties will be expected to have a coherent position on that. And of course, I shouldn't play down the extent to which there's a lot of gossiping over here at the moment about the old AfD party, which is in extremely hot water after an assistant to an MEP was arrested on spying allegedly for China. There's been a couple of other incidents involving AfD staffers allegedly receiving funds as well from Russia. And so that sort of spy drama, which is very much germane to the wider issue of the war in Ukraine, that would, it would be fair to say, be quite a big conversation topic over here.
Coming up, we hear Dom, Francis and James' final thoughts.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Let's move then to our final thoughts. Francis or Dom, who would like to go first?
Yeah, thanks, David. I'll just note before I get on to my final thought, I've just checked the Air Alert app and the alert is still on over Kharkiv. It's now covering the entire country. So Air Alert right now covering the entire country. That means that the authorities are much better at identifying where things are at risk. So it used to be that if there was something in the air that could potentially threaten an area of the country, that the alert would go off. What that meant was that people just ignored it. So actually in the last couple of years, they've worked hard to develop the app, and you can put in a much smaller of pertinence to you, and it will only alert when something is directly threatening that area. So it's a bid to try and get more people to take notice and head to the shelters when necessary. But as of now, just check the app again, the entire country is red, indicating that there's either something in the air or something heading in that direction that could threaten those areas of Ukraine. As a final thought, the Australian Parliament is currently running an inquiry into Australia's support for Ukraine. Thanks, Jason, for alerting us to this. So the government in Australia are seeking views on whether Australian support for Ukraine was timely, coordinated and comprehensive, whether the support is appropriately coordinated on a whole-of-government and whole-of-country basis, and they're also asking for comments about Australia's efforts to hold Russia to account, including by addressing mis- and disinformation in Australian public debate and more broadly. So, details are on the Parliament of Australia website. If you are an Australian citizen or live in Australia, you've got until the 10th of May to have your say. So head over there, add some comments. There's quite a few hours leafing through this morning. But yeah, that's on for another week. And thanks again to Jason for pushing that in our direction.
Well, thank you very much, Dom. Francis Sterling, would you like to go next?
Thanks, David. We've reflected on leadership a fair bit this week, especially with friend of the podcast, Elliot Cohen. If you missed that on Wednesday, I highly recommend listening back. Since we're on the subject, Yanan Ganesh has written an interesting perspective on the premiership of Joe Biden in the Financial Times. It has implications for President Zelensky too, which is why I leave listeners with it today. So to quote from the piece, "One thing above all, eloquence in politics is overrated. So is charisma, vision setting, and all the other performance aspects of politics. Biden was an average to poor communicator even before his age-related deterioration. He has no signature speech or even epigram to show for half a century in frontline politics. What he does have is more inside experience of Washington, its details, its unwritten codes, than any president ever. The result is a one-term legacy that exceeds what such silver tongues as Bill Clinton managed in two. The haggling over Ukraine was instructive. For weeks, Biden applied private pressure on Mike Johnson, the House Speaker, showing him intelligence briefings, but never badgering him in front of voters or Republican colleagues. Biden understood, as his more outwardly gifted predecessors didn't always, the importance of face. Something, too. He can count. A leader can't be so presentationally inept as to be unelectable. But once that low standard is met, there are diminishing returns to star power. Britain's two greatest post-war leaders were the taciturn Clement Attlee and the plodding communicator Margaret Thatcher. Much of her charisma has been ascribed to her in retrospect. Their nation-changing qualities, stamina, focus, certitude, were in the private side of politics, which is most of politics." Now, he's right, of course, to stress the virtues of intimacy with the complex machinery of politics. That's something Robert Caro stresses in his magisterial biography of Lyndon B. Johnson, especially the third volume, Master of the Senate, which, by the way, if someone were to ask me what series of non-fiction books would be read and revered in a century's time, would be my choice. They're really a biography of America's century and of power itself. We tend, of course, to want outsiders in our present age in our politics, but rarely can they learn how to get things done in the time frame available to them. Just look at Barack Obama, who says as much in his memoirs. It also poses a challenge for Zelensky, who's simultaneously trying to transform Ukrainian society as well as fight this war. Also offers a different perspective on Biden too. Although, of course, a great leader, a statesman, inhabits both star power and the ability to push politics forward internally in the way that's described there. The great Theodore Roosevelt springs to mind. But that's enough history for this week, David.
Well, thank you very much, Dom and Francis. James, would you like the very final words for this week?
Yes, I think the events of the last few weeks or so have shown that Russian hybrid warfare against Germany really seems to be on the increase again. We've discussed previously these exposed spying plots involving Russia. We've also talked about the case that's happened where essentially, and I can't remember if we talked about this at the start of the episode, but there's been a Russian cyber attack on the ruling SPD party, that's Chancellor Olaf Scholz's party, which earlier this morning, Annalena Baerbock, the foreign minister, disclosed. She accused a hacking collective that's controlled by Russia's GRU of being behind it. And I think something to look out for in the weeks to come, in light of these Russian spying plots, in light of cyber espionage, is whether that might move the dial in Berlin, whether it may spur Chancellor Scholz and his fellow ministers onto taking a much tougher stance on Moscow. We will just have to wait and see.
Well, thank you very much, Dom Nichols, James Rothwell and Francis Sternley, for your thoughts today. Just one note from me, just a huge thanks from all of us here at the podcast to Claire Hubble, the head of social media at The Telegraph, who's leaving The Telegraph today. Today's her final day. And listeners from the beginning will remember, of course, that Claire did actually host the podcast for around a month when I was in hospital. So a huge thanks to Claire. Best of luck for the future. And we couldn't have done this without you. Thank you, Claire.
Thank you, Dom, Francis and James. On day 767, we interviewed Natasha and Jeffrey Hartman from the charity Ukrainian Action about their project to help Ukrainian veterans deal with PTSD and reintegrate into society. Their fundraiser in London raised over £67,000 on the night, in addition to many donations and offers of help from our listeners. They wished to express their gratitude to everyone who reached out. At the fundraiser, Francis spoke to Eduard Fesko, the acting ambassador of Ukraine to the United Kingdom, about Kyiv's urgent needs, the challenge of serving in such a role, and the implications of events in the Middle East for Ukraine. Here is their conversation.
The thing that we need right now is the military kit. And from the military kit, of the utmost importance is air defense systems, Patriots and SAMTs, because those are the things that can intercept ballistic missiles. And the reason why it is important, from the beginning of the invasion, there were over 8,000 cruise missiles, there were over 5,000 ballistic missiles, there were over 9,000 UAVs of the Shahed type sent against targets in Ukraine. And to give the perspective, it's every day, every single day from February 24 to 2022, it's 30 projectiles hitting or targeting Ukrainian cities. And it's a huge number. Every single day, over 10 cruise missiles, over 10 ballistic missiles, and 15 Shahed drones are flying in Ukraine. That's why we need air defense systems. And that's why our president said that when we shoot down 5, 6, but 2 or 3 get through and they do the damage. That is really making a difference. That's why quite a bit of our energy infrastructure is gone. It's basically gone. Now we can say in the spring, summertime, maybe the population will not feel it, but winter comes, and when the winter comes, everybody will feel it. Stop procrastinating and stop acting as politicians. Start acting as statesmen. Because you have been entrusted with lots of power by your people. So you have a lot of responsibility to them. And it's not only about pleasing one group or another or somebody else. It's about doing the right thing in the long term. So your horizon should be not the next election. Your horizon should be the next generation of children. What kind of world are you leaving to them? That's your responsibility.
What are the biggest challenges that you found as acting ambassador? What important points or nuances do you sometimes find politicians fail to understand on the Ukraine issue?
I think the biggest thing that I am trying to communicate is the sense of urgency. Because when we come to our allies and present the needs, these things were needed yesterday. It's not a long-term project for a week, a month, half a year. It means that these things are needed here and now, and we are basically catching up. And this is something that many people do not grasp. Many politicians do not grasp. Some of them start awakening to this urgency, but still, for many of them, of course, they have to take into consideration their own domestic agendas, other pressures. But sometimes when we deliver these messages, we are being met with looks, oh, really? And that is something that is really striking. And sometimes you have to be very blunt. So, yes, if we are asking for this here and now, it means that we do need it.
Now, of course, your successor, Zeluzhny, will be coming in position in the next few weeks. In his famous essay in The Economist, he talked about the need for a technological leap in weaponry. Some people say that that's not likely in the short term, that really actually more urgent is a policy leap, which, to your point, is statesmen coming out and saying, maybe we need to lay red lines down in Ukraine about this far and no further. There's been some inklings that the French are beginning to talk a little bit like that. And I know that, of course, a lot of this is very sensitive. But do you get a sense that the right kind of conversations are happening in that vein, that moves beyond the purely technological, the weapons, the ammunition, but actually enters a more political conversation?
I think we are moving in the right direction. We very much welcome the discussion that was started by President Macron. However, when we look at the front line, and you know very well that Ukraine has been supplied quite a bit of military kit, it means that stockpiles in the Western countries among our friends have been really dipped into. So the question is, how actively are those stockpiles being replenished? I may be wrong, maybe I don't know everything, but I hope that all the production lines are working overtime, that new production lines are being added, because Russia is doing that.
Yes.
I don't know whether everybody in the West is doing that. I hope our Western allies are just more discreet and not advertising this, but we'd like to see more of action and not just discussions on the military security issues in general, because everybody is aware of the importance of modernizing militaries in the West, making sure that they are up to the task in the future. But we've also seen very bitter political debates about procurement budgets and everything else, which is, I think, is healthy, but at the same time, action is needed. And that is something that I think we'll see in the future, but I still think the pace is not sufficient.
Of course, another challenge for Ukraine is the impact of the current volatile situation in the Middle East. What have you seen the impact being of that? Has it distracted from Ukraine, in your view? And a further question to that is, if the West had stepped in to repel the Iranian attack on Israel, if it had done that for Ukraine, what do you think the situation would be now?
These two wars are very different. And what is obvious that after October the 7th, after the horrific events in southern Israel, lots of attention of the world has been focused on what is happening in Gaza. And it's all fair, absolutely. However, with direct impact, for example, some of the stockpiles of artillery shells that were to be delivered to Ukraine because of the conflict that started in the Middle East have not been delivered to Ukraine. Now, with the latest Iranian missile and drone combined attack against Israel, lots of countries, of course, would have seen the importance of effective and efficient air defense. That means it will be probably more difficult for us to lobby to get results in terms of ensuring deliveries of air defense systems to Ukraine, because many countries may be reluctant to give them at this point. So these kind of impacts are very real and very tangible. At the same time, I think when we talk about the decision of Israel, France, to shoot down some of the incoming missiles and drones over the territories of third countries, it does raise huge questions in Ukraine why they cannot do the same in Ukraine, where over our territory, when we ask them, when we give them permission to do so, thousands of kilometers from the front line over Western Ukraine. So they inability or the lack of readiness to do so still leaves us with lots of questions, because it's about engaging missiles, not fighter jets. So the argument about that this kind of engagement may result in a military encounter with the Russian forces is absolutely not true, because it's just hardware, which, by the way, those missiles and drones have been sometimes found in the territories of NATO countries.
Yeah, Romania and...
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Well, you've, in a sense, taken my next question from me, which was going to be exactly that, which is, you hear the excuse often being put forward by Western leaders that it would be a direct provocation or an escalation, which is the term that is often utilised, of shooting down these missiles. And this would not be an instance of shooting down Russian pilots, that these are actually missiles that are perpetrating war crimes, that they are on civilian targets. They are not just attacking factories or military bases. Is that case being made when you're speaking to MPs? And what kind of response do you get to that?
Believe me, the conversations on this subject have been quite exhaustive.
I can imagine.
With our Western allies. But there is still this, I will go even as far as to say, irrational fear or concern over escalation. And we honestly do not get what kind of escalation are we afraid of, because we are not talking about nuclear things. We are talking about shooting down missiles over territories, even NATO countries, which allies appear to be too reluctant to take action against. And this, I think, only encourages Russians to do more, because they see reluctance on the part of the West, of the NATO, to do something resolute in response. So it's self-fulfilling promise. Okay, we will abstain from action, so the other side will just ramp up the pressure.
And that's something, of course, that has been spoken about many times on the podcast. Edward, it's really interesting hearing your perspective of what is, in a sense, a very, very fast-moving situation. Are there any other further thoughts that you'd want to leave our listeners with that's on your mind that may not be on ours?
I think what is important at this stage of the war is that in Ukraine, we do need more action, and not just promises, commitments, announcements, new coalitions, which we all very welcome. But for us, what counts in the end is the end result. And it's not only about the military kit, it's also on the political front. One of the biggest deliverables over these last 2 years was the invitation to Ukraine to join the EU. So we have started the process. The big question remains, where is NATO? What is the holdup? And of course, we do have the security agreements with a number of countries. But let's not forget that those are memorandums of understandings, basically non-legally binding documents. So they are not a substitute for concrete, tangible, enforceable security guarantees.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk/Ukraine the Latest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our Ukraine newsletter, which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine live blog on our website, where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. London time each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload. So if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it is released, do refer to the podcast apps. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, leave a review, as it helps others find the show. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. And you can contact us directly on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in the description for this episode. As ever, we are especially interested to hear where you are listening from around the world. Ukraine the Latest was produced by Rachel Porter, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.